way that I overloaded. I would, no matter what I did, I backed off the control. I would overload the input of the receiver. At times, even on signals that weren't as strong as expected Z overload. And basically, the what was wrong, I guess, eventually, I did find it, that something happened to the MOSFET on the input, because when I replaced it, everything went back to normal. The only thing I did notice that my signal-to-noise ratio had, that the dynamic range went down and my gain had decreased, even though I noticed, that, like I say, that it had a tendency to overload the receiver. Is that similar to what you're seeing, Joe, over?
Well, let me just say this about the preamp. It has no, there's no adjustability to the gain of the preamp. It has an internal regulator, which obviously operates somewhere around, must be below the supply voltage, because you can run the preamp from, say 12 to 18 volts, or 12 to 15 volts comfortably, and it's happy with that. So as long as it gets 12.6, 13 volts on the preamp itself, it works. It's fine. This is done. This test was done with two different preamps, and it was done with one that just even came back from A2R that was repaired and certified by them to have less than a half a dB noise figure and 20 dB a gain. So the preamp is not the issue here. I'm just trying to figure out what stage in the receiver could have got hammering it. It is a very unusual problem. I've never encountered this myself.
Okay, but I'm saying, you said that without the preamp, if you take the preamp out of the line, use the receiver as it originally came from the manufacturer, you did say the receiver is working normal, am I correct?
Yes, the receiver has a figure of about, say, that range for 20 dB of quieting. It used to work with the preamp. When you put the preamp in, the reading went down to about minus 125, 120, no, about 126. For 20 dB of quantity, it really pulled it up quite a bit. I know you can't realize your full gain, the full gain of the preamp. It's not going to make a 0.2 receiver work like something at 0.02. I just realize you hit a certain threshold of the noise floor. You're just not going to get something that's not there. This was run on a repeater, and the problem was the guy had a problem with something. May have happened to the antenna. And he may have had a lot of energy come down and overload the preamp. That's it blew out the preamp once. But I'm not sure what kind of damage that did afterwards, but it popped something in the receiver itself, like the first RF amp or the mixer.
That's always a possibility, right? The damage, when you say damage, it's not like it was, years ago. A lot of the times when you had damage to a lot of bipolar type of devices, they were just either popped open or shorted. MOSFETs, most of the receivers will use an FET, JFET N-channel or P-channel type of devices on the input. And they can get, like I say, I have had ones that, if you measure them by any conventional, way of measuring, you really couldn't find, something really wrong, definitely wrong with them. Yet, like I say, in the preamp, what I did is I replaced the MOSFET, and it just happened to be this preamp had control, that you were able to control it. And when I noticed that the difference in the control, now when I replaced it, everything more or less went back to normal. I tested for whatever I could test on the MOSFET, couldn't find anything really wrong with it other than replaced it. This is a situation that many times the, subtle changes in these devices are almost unmeasurable by, unless maybe under laboratory standards. And many times the only way is if you suspect, a device bad, and the device that's easily damaged is usually, the FET show over.
Okay, this preamp, I believe, uses a gas FET. It's a gas FET type preamp. So they make the same ones for 2 meters, same ones for 450. It's a very popular preamp. It's gone, just like that. And they tell you that you must put some sort of pass cavity in front of this thing to protect it from outside static discharges. It was, because it's being run through a pass-notch duplexer.
Yeah, Roger, okay, yeah, with a gas fed, yes, definitely. I would say that, a thing like that, it doesn't have to take much without a protection on the gate. It's not going to take very much to, damage that type of device. And I would definitely say that you should have a protection cavity or something in for, static electricity that we generate in the air with all lightning starts dancing around. That is very sensitive, A gate, an unprotected gate like that on a gas set, can easily be damaged, Joe, with...
Okay. Well, I did a test on this, and when he sent one preamp back and come back from A²R, they repaired it. They replaced the device in there. I tested it without it being hooked up to the repeater in its normal operation. I put a signal into the thing and looked at the output on a spectrum analyzer, and I was able to measure the gain, see it had a 20 dB gain factor from input to output, and I increased the generator, and I actually watched it to a point of how much I could put into it before it started to flat top and compress, and they seemed to agree around it compresses at like plus 12 dBm or something like that, and I got similar readings to that. So that kind of told me that the preamp looked like, as far as I could tell, was operating correctly. Of course, I can't measure the noise figure because I don't have an HP, noise figure meter to be able to measure, but I was using an HP spectrum analyzer, a very good quality analyzer to measure the gain, and of course a good quality signal generator putting a signal source in. So both preamps measure the same way, but yet they don't work with the particular receiver anymore. I'm just trying to nail it down as far as what could be wrong with the receiver, because I don't believe the preamp is a problem.
To the input of the receiver, and it could be it's a very subtle damage. It's not something that you're going to take an instrument, simply put on and say, aha, here it is. This is a situation like I had that transistors in the front end there. This is usually where it goes. The front end, like I say, are, many times very easily static damaged without any kind of, even with protection, even with, taking some precautions. And it's up there, connected to an antenna, being exposed to lots of real thick spikes, and it wouldn't take much to damage the one of the input devices of the receiver. Quite sensitive to that. They tell you when you're handling them, be very careful of static electricity, which of course you can do on the bench easily, ground yourself and all, take for the environment. There isn't much we can do, try to protect the input to some extent, but with the amount of, what's out there at times, the big spikes, there's not much we can, really do 100% show over.
Okay, well, I guess I'll just poke around this a little more. Maybe this might be a question to throw at Dick when he comes and checks it on the net later. I even tried the trick of putting I didn't have a 1 dB pad, I put a 3 dB pad after the preamp, try to make it realize it more of a 50-ohm law, because I know these things they become a little unhappy looking into the helical front end of some of these newer receivers, or even older ones, because they're not a 50-ohm match. And I've heard that sometimes that makes the preamp run a little more stably, in a stable condition, by seeing a more, better impedance. But even that effect had no effect on the overall measurement. I mean, the gain figure went up and down with the matching pad, but overall it was actually worse by about 6 dB. With the preamp in, so it told me something was wrong inside the 220, this guy's 220 receiver. Something happened to it, something hammered, something inside. But, all right, maybe there's something to throw at Dick when he checks in later on. Maybe he might have a little more insight on it. It'll be here tomorrow. I can taste the next guy. Thanks.
Okay, Joe. Yeah, possibility Dick may have had some experience, but from past experience, like I say, I've seen a number of pieces of equipment like that repeaters that had lightning damage, and they ranged everywhere from insensitivity to sometimes strange problems. And almost in every case, it was traced right to directly to the input, where is the most vulnerable spot. All right, well, like I say, Dick should be in here within about a half hour, and maybe he has some more insights. Thank you very much, Joe, for joining us, and we'll catch up with you a little later. So anybody else want to join us before we go over to Paul with the space report? And, of course, we can also discussed. I hope everybody was able to get a good look at that wonderful eclipse last night. Anybody else want to make any calls for any questions before we go over to WS2N? Over.
N2MB, no comments. Just want to let you know I'm here and listening and enjoying the net. Good evening, Mel. N2MB Mobile.
Oh, hello, Barry. Gee, haven't heard you around for a while. Hope all is well with you. Haven't heard you on 75 meters. Maybe you want to give us a couple of comments on how you're doing with your antenna system.
Okay, actually, I'm waiting for some key parts to come in, and I have to call the guy, Chokes, to put at the end of both of the wires and some coax and everything, but it never arrived, so I have to call him during the week. In the meantime, I've been able to just make some comparisons between the effect of having a vertical antenna and a horizontal one. Still stick to what I originally said. If you could only have one antenna, I am now becoming more and more convinced, make it a horizontal one. I would say that about 10% of the time, the vertical outperforms the horizontal, which means about 90% of the time, the horizontal is outperforming the vertical. On those rare moments, you know, you wonder, why am I making a two-element vertically polarized beam? Perhaps I would be smarter. I'm starting to think that one out, and I might consider it. And over to you, Mel, N2MB Mobile.
Okay, Barry, N2MB Mobile, K2KEY with a Weimark TechNet. Well, let me tell you, you know, I've been doing a lot of it. Actually, tell you how your signal is coming in more better on a, is a vertically polarized signal or a horizontally polarized signal. I mean, of course, we're talking the signal at a little bit of distance. Now, I get on with my friend George in Pennsylvania every night on 75 WB3FRY. He's over in the western portion of Pennsylvania near the Ohio border. Now, some nights I receive him on the horizontal, you know, the outside full wave, one wavelength loop that I use, and he, you know, got a pinning signal, and I mean, his signal's banging in the needle right up against the end of the pin. Other nights, the signal is considerably lower. And what I do to, of course, the noise level at times also goes along with it. It's to be high, and the only way I can receive him then is on the receiving loop, which, of course, I can turn, twist, and everything. And I notice many a time when he is weak on the outside one wavelength loop, and then I'm listening to him on the receiving loop, which I'm able, like I say, to maneuver it a different way, his signal is coming in more vertically polarized than it is horizontally. So you can see definitely. Now, in many cases, it's even it's not horizontal, it's not vertical, it's somewhere in between. He's horizontally polarized, it's a dipole, just a regular dipole stretched between two places that, you know, there's no variation in the height or the way it's positioned, so it's a perfect way, you know, to evaluate what's going on. So, saying that, you know, I've always said that you need, in many cases, a variety of antennas, especially on HF. There are times, no doubt, the horizontal antenna is going to work like gangbusters, and other times you hear a number of people with phased vertical. They get on and, oh boy, they're working the DX in places, and, or they'll get on with the pay difference, and other ones, people are saying, oh, phenomenal difference. So I can't really say, you know, to you, Barry, that the answer is horizontal or vertical. N2MB, K2KEY.
Okay, Mel. Well, I told you I have a little bit of a kind of a theory why these guys with these phased verticals are doing so well, and it's kind of an unkind statement, but I find I also, like yourself, I have a really beautiful kilowatt amplifier, and whenever I switch the kilowatt amplifier on, they tell me I am much louder, And I can tell you from my experiences, I have heard nobody using phase verticals who wasn't at the same time using a giant kilowatt amplifier, probably bigger than mine. So I'm starting to think that these guys are getting these fantastic reports because they're running fantastic power. Because what I do, I get fantastic reports. I mean, the easiest way to kick in another 9 dB is to hit the amplifier switch. I find that the antenna, maybe I'm wrong, but when the antenna is all done, I should see, when everybody is in the right place in front of it, about a 3 dB advantage to having it. At that point, when I switch from the vertical to the horizontal, I'll probably see a slight improvement on the vertical.
I believe you're running 100, and you have a rig, I believe, that can go to the maximum power, you know, going 15 times the power is going to produce a pronounced difference. My friend in Pennsylvania, many nights, even I could say, even if I could adjust the loop to pick him up, without him putting the amplifier on, I just could not make copy on him. I know when he sticks that Collins amp on, that it's like, I could say, night and day, a considerable gain. So, again, yes, no doubt the power has a big factor there. And, whether or not, you know, I can say you definitely go horizontal and forget about the vertical, the phase, you know, four square. I don't know. I really don't know. But again, you did make a good statement saying you've got to have the real estate. If you do have the real estate, you can put a variety of antennas. But put up a horizontal beam on 80 meters, Barry, I think you're going to be overlapping a few people's properties over.
Oh, definitely. No, I'm not going to do that at this time. I do find that the phase verticals have a beautiful front-to-back ratio and side lobe rejection. That they do. So a lot of times you'll find when these guys switch to their vertical arrays, their directional arrays, you're not hearing gain. What you're hearing is the signal gets markedly weaker to us because they're looking in another direction. So we're seeing their front-to-back ratio or side lobe rejection, and that is impressive, by the way. That can be a tremendous help because the more static you eliminate, just atmospheric static, I mean, the louder these guys are going to, and cooler these guys are going to be. So there is an advantage to having these directional arrays, but I guess more in the front-to-back and side rejection. And, you know, it just, you have the illusion that it's got gain because you're listening to a station, you throw the switch, but all of a sudden, boy, is he clear. That's not gain. That's just rejection of noise, you know. I've been doing this experiment for several more months, and believe me, by the time I'm ready to report back to this net, I will really know what I'm talking about. I'm being really open-minded about this, and I'm not getting suckered in, you know, by, you know, these S9 signal reports that everybody gives you. I'm paying real careful attention to what's happening, though, and to MB Mobile.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I know. Well, that's why the receiving loop seems to be my little nudge there to, you know, give me a little extra help at times because the noise level at times is pretty horrible. So what I do is I have the receiving loop, and I have that homebrew, you know, the QRN squasher, the Q multiplier that I made up. And with that in the line, I'm able to, you know, get a good null many times on the noise as long as it's, you know, really not coming from 14 directions at one time, if it's more or less predominant from one direction. So I'm able to just get the somewhat of a null on that noise, get the phase adjustment just right so that I get good separation. I can get usually a fairly good separation. I get about approximately, I can, going through the amplifier after the Q multiplier, I can usually achieve somewhere like a 10 dB gain out right at that point, 10 volt dB gain. So that, and then I can, with the Q multiplier, get approximately a good high dynamic range of maybe 100 dB or better. So, you know, that combination is the only way you're going to beat a lot of that noise situation on 75 meters. So, you know, there are times, like I say, the only answer is most likely, I should say, need a different type of antenna situation for different situations. But most of the time, is you got to get rid of the local noise is what gives you the problem. You can't hear them, Barry, so how are you going to work them? There's the bottom line. If you can't hear them, you can't work them over.
I couldn't agree with you more. If you can't hear them, you can't work them. And that's the advantage of these directional arrays, I think. More than anything, they get rid of noise. They get rid of other stations. They get rid of static. You know, they whatever you want to call it, signals to noise ratio, whatever, it makes it much, much better. The advantage there could be 13 to 15 dB, and that's serious. That's where these guys are shining when they suddenly hear guys that they couldn't hear before because they're getting rid of all this atmosphere sudden. It's like a miracle. That I'm noticing, and that is, you know, that to me is more important than the gain. As you say, you can't hear them, you can't work them. And getting back to them, all you got to do is run a ton of power. That would do it.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, I find that with the receiving loop system, that many a signal, I take out some low, really low signals that you would never believe that, you know, I have, like I say, the one wavelength the loop I'm transmitting on, the one wavelength, and if I compare that to a receiving loop, you'd say, oh boy, God, come on, you must be joking. But the receiving loop, in most every case, is at least equal to the transmitting loop or better. And when I say better is because when I can do so much more with the signal to noise ratio, that's where it outshines, because there's nothing much I could do with the one wavelength loop outside there when the noise level gets crazy. I mean, it really takes off sometimes that, you know, forget about it. It's not within, you know, any way that you're going to hear a signal. The signal could be 25 over 9, but that noise level is so high that, you know, it's obnoxious to, you know, try to make a contact even with stations that are fairly local. So many times, I could say, a simple device like that receiving loop, which is not a complicated thing to put together, could do so much for you, Barry, that you just sit there and you scratch it. This is one of the answers to my problem, you know. It's kind of crazy at times that you would, you know, even consider it over.
I got a question for you when you get a chance. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, I'm going to give it back to you guys because right now I'm getting new. As soon as I get, I'm lost. Good evening, Dick, and to MV Mobile.
Hope you don't get lost, Barry. Mel, what's going to be an awful lot of fun if you get a chance to run the experiment would be to talk to your buddy in Pennsylvania. While he's transmitting, you twist the loop in as and L and tilt and whatever until you get the strongest signal or strongest signal to noise ratio, whichever you prefer. I think I would go for strongest signal on this particular experiment. And then hopefully if he's on the telephone with you and you send a signal back to him with a tone to it, whatever, and you tune your loop while you're transmitting through it until he gets the strongest signal. You'd have to be doing this QRP to be safe, but still, I think there's a good chance you're going to find out that the way you tune the loop when you're sending it back to him is entirely different than the way you set the azimuth and the elevation of the loop when you're listening. And if that's true, it would be a very strong confirmation of non-reciprocity. In other words, because of the twist of Faraday rotation when the signal goes through the ionosphere to get from Manhattan Beach to Pennsylvania, it twists one way when it goes from east to west, and it twists another way when it goes from west to east, and therefore the tuning could very well be different. So with a telephone, you could confirm that. That would be a fun experiment if your buddy in Pennsylvania can feed it back to you, if you know what I mean. K2KEY, KTRIW.
Yeah, Yeah, Roger. Well, I did one experiment similar to that because I did run into another gentleman also using a commercially made receiving loop that you know, the company was putting them out some years ago called ATA. And he confirmed the same thing. I was, you know, basically just what you said. I had the loop set a certain way for him, and he had his loop set a certain way for me. Of course, they're two different loops, but I would assume they would behave basically the same. And like you say, the east to west, from west to east, no doubt the Faraday rotation could be, you know, considerably different. Not subtle, but considerably different. Okay, Dick, I'm happy to have you back. Believe me, not the same net without you, and hopefully you're feeling great again, and happy birthday to you. Mine is coming up right after you, within a short period. And we do end, Paul. I held him off here and say, oh, wait, for a little while to discuss what's going on in space, especially well, I was able to get a bit of a view of the eclipse last night. Unfortunately, in the city of New York, when you're there, you know, the atmosphere is not as clear as you'd like to view in anything in space. And WA2RYY Joe was in, and he had a peculiar taste there, and oh, I don't think I answered the question maybe exactly the way you may. And then I had also an email that we can also get to that a repeat of something that we did a couple of weeks ago. So you can pick it up now, Dick, and I'll stand by. And like I say, you can take it in any order you like. Maybe you want to... I don't know if you were able to hear any of the conversations, previous conversations, Dick. K2RIW and the TechNet, K2KEY.
W2OSR. W2OSR. Sounds like Bob. This is new call, new fancy call. We're going to get to him in a second. Yeah, I was really feeling pretty sick with that flu last week when Mel took over, and we're glad he did. And then a couple days ago was my actual official birthday, and my family threw me a surprise party tonight, so that's the reason I'm late. I guess we can review Joe and Bob and go over to Paul, and by then Barry will have unlost himself, and we'll discuss further things with Mr. Forrest. So, let's see. Bob, I think it sounds to me like you want to make a comment. W2OSR. And how did you choose OSR, Bob? Nice sounding call. K2LIW.
Oh, good evening, Dick, from W2OSR. W2OSR was chosen because the OS and the R stand for Honduran Scout Reservation. People who know me know I'm involved with the Boy Scouts. Quick question, which hopefully somebody can answer for me. I'm just trying to find out, where can I get a piece of antenna mast? I'm going to be putting a beam up for 20, 15, and 10, and I'm going to need something to go from the rotor to the antenna. The rest of it, I think I've got resolved.
Yeah, in the old days, I used to go over to the Reynolds Aluminum Company in Farmingdale. I don't think they're there anymore. Farmingdale, Deer Park. They were very close to Grand Boulevard in Deer Park, just east of Comac Road. And they had a great big warehouse there that was about an acre of aluminum tubing, mostly aluminum tubing, lined up around the walls and on shelves and whatever. 24-foot length and 12-foot length and scrap pieces, every diameter, every wall thickness, every alloy you wanted. So you walked in there and picked up a hunk and said, yeah, that's what I want, and then find out how much it costs. That was fun. I don't think they're there anymore, although there's got to be another place on Long Island that sells tubing like that. So brand new aluminum tubing, that's one way to go. From time to time, there have been people who sell scrap aluminum in the Brentwood area. Was it Brentwood? Somewhere near the South Shore, not too far from Brentwood, Islip area. There used to be a scrap dealer that would have a great big warehouse of scrap aluminum. And I think there are ham radio websites where people will advertise aluminum tubing that they've got that they're not using. My favorite construction material when it comes to antennas is aluminum. When it comes to the tower itself, I don't like aluminum for the tower. I think it's more trouble than it's worth. Galvanized steel is the right way to go when it comes to the tower. But almost everything else on the tower should either be galvanized stainless steel or aluminum, in my opinion. So I guess you're looking for a 12-foot or an 18-foot mast to go into the tower, connect to the rotator, and then hold your main antenna, the one you've been refurbishing, that Cushcraft, and then all the other VHF antennas that are going to go above it. Is that approximately the same, Bob? 32OSR, K2RIW.
Davidson Aluminum,
aha, Davidson Aluminum. Where is Davidson Aluminum located these days? Are they in the Deer Park area still?
I think they were in New Jersey. I'm just unsure. I can't guarantee that, but I think a couple of years ago you said they were in New Jersey. KB2MAR.
Okay, KB2MAR. We gave us that information. So the name Davidson Aluminum and Reynolds Aluminum, if you look them up in the yellow pages, I'll bet you there's at least one place in Long Island City, and you probably don't have to even leave Long Island to find aluminum tubing. I guarantee Long Island uses a lot of aluminum tubing, so this got up.
KC2MDP with a comment. All right, W2OSR. I'll listen to the comment after I say my little piece. I don't need anything that long, Dick. I'm only planning on putting up the tri-bander, so, you know, probably at least 2 to 3 feet long would be more than enough. Just enough to get the antenna slightly above the rotor, since it's not going to be mounted in a conventional tower. It's going to be mounted on an MA-40 pole tower. So I don't want too much hanging above the rotor because it'll put too much stress on everything. All right, back to you, Dick.
And Toral, do you comment?
Okay, Steve, N2RLP. We'll get to you after Steve. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, Bob, what diameter of tubing are you looking for? Probably inch and a half, I think. You can go to any electrical supply store. They sell aluminum conduit. That's what I use, because I'm in the field, so I get it basically for nothing. Back to you.
Okay, sounds good. I'll check with my local electrical supply place.
Okay, was it N2ROP? Give me the call letters again and your name, and go ahead with your comments, sir.
Beat me to it. Any electrical supply will sell you any 10-foot length of aluminum conduit. They work great. That's what I'm using. My name is Carl, Kilo Alpha Romeo Lima. Call is N2RLD, as in David. And that's what I was going to suggest. Conduit is the best thing to use. I've been using it for years, and it's nice and light, the aluminum, it drills nicely, so you can put the bolt through the rotor, and it's nice and strong.
And Carl, is that conduit that electrical contractors use, most of the time they're using it indoors? To your knowledge, is that a aluminum alloy that is suggested for proper use outdoors, or is there a slight variation for outdoor use? You got a call.
Nope, it's for outdoor use. It's for direct burial outdoor use. It's used for everything. So it'll stand up to the weather nicely.
Carl, what's the longest length, what's the biggest diameters that I can buy for conduit tubing at a typical electrical supply house?